Hi, everyone, and welcome to This Anthropological Life. As always, I'm Anil Tripathi.
And I'm Ryan Collins.
So this, recently we were joined by a very special guest, Asli Zengin, who's the Alan Berenson Fellow in Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies here at Brandeis University. And she came on, joined Ryan and I on This Anthropological Life to talk about her research in Turkey, specifically on transgender issues of regulation with Turkey's government. Her research interests include sexuality, gender, trans studies, queer theory, the body, intimacy, kinship and relatedness, critical social theory, medical and legal anthropology, anthropology of violence, anthropology of the state, anthropology of space, and contemporary issues in the Middle East. So an incredibly vast array of expertise and knowledge that she brought to our conversation, which we really tried to dive into the specifics of her field research, the nature of all these issues that she looks at, and from a very This Anthropological Life perspective, how her project really unfolded through time.
Exactly. And we really dove into a lot of good issues about the borders of our own research. What sort of access do we have when it comes to doing field work, the perspectives that we each carry with us, and what types of experiences, unique experiences, that we actually all bring to the table and that we'll get to participate in with the people who are hopefully allowing us to participate with them in this field experience. And as we talk about with Asli, some of the really interesting key points of her own fieldwork process don't have to do so much with the boundaries between sex and gender, but so much in the solidification of gender norms that Turkey uses today, and it's really interesting how that's materially expressed.
Oh, yeah, and it was incredibly fascinating discussion on the kind of the material implementation of state regulation on transgender issues in Turkey. So we hope that you guys listen in, check out the clips we have from the interview. We've tried to be a bit creative with our conversation, cutting it up into different sections, which we found were incredibly valuable or poignant, as well as having the full interview for you guys to check out. So, give us some feedback. And we're very, very happy that we were able to get Asli on, and look forward to future conversations. Thanks, guys. It's such a great portrayal of how I think really good ethnographic work should happen, right? And, especially I think it's always good for, PhD students like myself to hear these stories as well, because, sometimes I think early anthropologists just starting out would feel like they have to know, they have to have such a concrete idea of what their study should be and what they're going to do. Because I think in a way, that's the model that people expect, from scientists, from social scientists, as, we kind of create our study. But then in anthropology, one of the things that I think is so great about our discipline is that it's very much supported. And, I think sometimes it's even seen you're really not kind of being fully an anthropologist if your project isn't changing. Because if it doesn't change, you're really, what are you really discovering? Mm-hmm. And so much of this discovery from our research happens when we change our perceptions, right? Because we're trying to create a type of knowledge which really, I think, hopes to save what lies between, the boundaries of so many other types of knowledge, and types of knowledge that can be sometimes very violent, such as we've been discussing state knowledge here. So I was just wondering if you had any more thoughts, perhaps, on kind of anthropological research in general. And
this is a great conversation, actually. It can just go anywhere. It can just go wherever. But I want to tell you one specific story from my fieldwork, the fieldwork that I did with female sex workers, not necessarily transgender people, because it was a very learning process for me back in the day. As I told you, the state was drawing this boundary between illegal and legal, like licensed and unlicensed female sex workers, and it's legal to do sex work in Turkey. It's strictly regulated by the state, so there are specific brothels for female sex workers. Only female sex workers can just go into these brothels, and except for cleaning ladies and licensed female sex workers, no other women is allowed to enter these brothels.
Mm.
But men can just go as clients. So there is this kind of, you know, regulation of space, segregation of space based on the morality, how promiscuity, and what kind of a woman you are. You are a so-called like modest or immodest woman. So lots of boundary making between also different categories of women. So as a female, young female researcher, I was trying to get into these brothels. But there was no way. Like, I was trying to find a way, and I was trying to get some people, communicate with the sex workers working in the brothels, because most of them are also staying in the brothel.
Mm-hmm.
And they just spend the whole day until midnight from the early morning, and they have to go through medical checks twice a week. So I tried my chance with the hospital space first, and this is a very specific hospital that only takes care of female sex workers. So a person who is not a sex worker cannot also go to this hospital and receive medical aid. So I tried to get into this hospital space to meet with them during their breaks while they were waiting for their tests. So all this institutional space was closed to me. I tried with the Ministry of Health to get permissions, and they came up with these different kinds of excuses not to give me permission to get into this hospital space. They told me, for example, why don't you go and just work with some people in a productive clinic or just maternal clinic. Yeah, why don't you just work with the mothers or the pregnants? Why do you necessarily go for sex workers? This was the kind of
you should go work in the safe category.
And also what kind of women category they put in contrast to sex workers.
Yeah.
Okay, this
good
is
mothers.
A sex worker and a mother. So pregnant mothers, just, you know, if you're concerned about female health, that's how I had formulated my research, like sexual health, female health, and they were making suggestions. And I said, no, I just don't want to do this. I want to also work on the issue of HIV/AIDS. So I think this particular group is more prone to, so I might do better research about it. And I was trying to find ways to formulate my research, but it didn't work out in the end. I couldn't get any access. And I couldn't get into the brothel. And the first idea came to my mind to just, you know, maybe hire a male assistant who would just go to the brothel as a client. And what kind of ethical implications that kind of decision would just have. So I decided not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, what it means then to think about silence and invisibility itself? And what does it tell me about the operation and exercise of the state power? So sometimes we don't have access to some places, and we are like so stubborn to gain access to some places and ethnographers. But sometimes maybe like it's important to step back and what this access, like inability to have access, tells us about my gender relations in general, about like different boundaries of womanhood and different categories of womanhood. And what it means for the state to hold silence and produce silence around certain issues, what kind of messages we can just draw on by merely focusing on invisibility and silence. So I wrote a whole chapter on silence to talk about the state violence and state power.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very learning experience for me. I had to shift my analytical framework. I had to find ways to analyze this absence of data, why this data was absented for a particular researcher. Because if I was a male researcher,
I could have done it.
It could have been a different kind of, you know, research with the same people. So it's not only the field work itself, but also the question of positionality, what kind of social cultural position you hold as a researcher, and how it just, you know, shapes your research. These are really fascinating, you know, questions, and I'm sure everybody has their own kind of story around this question, so why they do fieldwork.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
of course. I think that shows another really important point about fieldwork is that, you know, it's a process where you yourself are fully involved as well, right? I mean, you're kind of an essential piece of the fieldwork as well, which goes back to in anthropology we have. The whole reflexive term in which a turn in which people had to really think about, you know, their own positionality in terms of their research. And I think, here on This Anthropological Life, we've always tried to bring in conversations about, you know, reflecting on the nature of anthropological research and how it exists, how all of us, you know, we exist within our own structures, right? And I think anthropology can really help us reflect on how this existence occurs and how you know, how much we can push these boundaries, as well as, you know, what we can learn from observing them as well. You know, here we are, Ryan and I are, you know, PhD students at Brandeis, and we've had a lot of conversations this podcast as well about, you know, trying to get more public anthropology out
yeah.
there,
mm-hmm.
getting anthropology, you know, beyond
yeah.
academia itself. And I think, you know, so much of this has to involves us, you know, trying to, you know, extend our own identities as well,
yeah.
because of a gap that we see in terms of, you know, where, you know, who has access to anthropological knowledge and just the ideas and the discipline itself, right?
Yeah, so. That's a great point. I think one of the things I like about anthropology that I feel like super fascinated about it is this, like, focus on the mundane, focus on the everyday, and how the everyday has lots of potential to open up certain kinds of questions that you don't necessarily, you know, see when you just focus on this, you know, very stereotypical macro analysis. It doesn't mean that anthropology wouldn't lead to macro analysis, but the way to look at the macro relations is goes through this very everyday. That is the fascinating part. It just gives us the right tools to connect the micro with the macro in the most, you know, productive way, just because of this ethnographic methods. And the other disciplines are now borrowing all this ethnographic methods selectively.
Mm-hmm.
So anthropology also provides a platform for this interdisciplinary research. I think it's important to establish this language and tools to talk to the other disciplines sorry, and just bring all the baggage together and just establish this, like, ways of translation between different forms of knowledge and between different forms of discipline. And I think anthropology so far has been the most successful discipline to do that among all the other, I mean, feminist studies and gender studies does that too. But they, again, like, borrow lots of methods from each other. And this is, this really amazes me.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think, you know, in anthropology, we're able to really, and that's why, you know, especially with regards to studying the everyday, right, I think it's so important, because when we study the everyday existences of people involved in these larger processes, right, so, you know, for instance, in your research, this process of, you know, the state ID cards and this whole, you know, transgender process and trying to change the cards, you know, so many people involved in these systems, it is their everyday life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard sometimes for so many people to view the full pictures in which they're connected to. And I think in anthropology, we can try to reflect on this, right? And I think you said it so well, the micro and the macro,
mm-hmm.
and trying to link it together through kind of seeing all the connections
yeah.
that are involved.
And I see it as a kind of tool for deciphering so many relations of power
mm-hmm.
and inequality. So I think if people get familiar with anthropological knowledge, they begin to also look around the world and from a very different perspective, see this, like, exactly how you say it, like how they are situated, located within a particular, you know, bigger picture that involves racialized relationships, gender relationships, ethnic relationships. I mean, so many parameters
mm-hmm.
shape a human, an individual's life condition. So I think anthropology gives us the right and the most useful tools to look at this very specific, unique human condition in the light of this existing relations of power and inequality.
I agree. I'm really struck just so much by this whole conversation on the different types of levels in which we'll see borders between knowledge, or the way in which power is enforced, and the levels that you're talking about. We're seeing the state level as being a heavy entity, and that's in stark contrast with the area of Latin America that I work in, where the national state is certainly an entity and people will vote in elections, but its presence is rarely known, if ever known. And the local communities that I tend to work in, those relationships tend to be the larger power dynamics, and you need to get past a sort of more personal basis to get at any type of boundaries between knowledge and information. And sometimes that's more of a linguistic aspect, speaking a Yucatecan Maya language as opposed to speaking Spanish or English. And so, again, I'm just struck by how creative anthropologists have to be on a global scale, moving between different types of scales, the types of knowledge that they can gain access to, while also recognizing when there is knowledge that you're missing as a researcher and how that can be beneficial to these larger social concerns.
Definitely. I mean, sometimes when I just think about the language issue, it's just an automatically the question of like being the native, quotation marks, being the native and the non-native researcher, and what it implicates, right? And so it also, it's another border-making process, like what kind of background you're coming from and what kind of doors are open to you as a native or non-native researcher. So it is... It is, in that sense, a constant negotiation of knowledge production as a researcher and what kind of, you know, relations are involved in this knowledge production and just how they are specific to your unique condition as an individual within this set of, you know, relations, who you are and what you can be, you can produce and what kind of abilities you might just, you know, develop because of these limitations depending on who you're where you're coming from. That's why all this like all situational knowledge, you know, all this discussion around situational knowledge, and not just, you know, all whatever we produce is subjective, never objective, and producing different accounts about the same community, same place, same location. This is also a very, beautiful thing to about like doing anthropological work. How each account, each ethnography is a specific account of that life. That there are, of course, commonalities, common stories, but the way they are articulated and the way they get filtered through the researcher's life story, through the researcher's position, produces this very specific accounts about these lives. I find it very, you know, amazing, this multiplicity.
I think so much, you know, is this constant play of sameness and difference in these stories. I mean, back to the standard kind of anthropological dictum, right? The make the strange familiar and the familiar strange.
Yeah.
And we're always playing, you know, in any identity, you know, that we have in relations to any other human being, there's always this constant play.
Yeah.
Right, which I think, you know, through anthropology we can really reflect on.
Yeah, definitely.
So, thinking about the future, not only of the field, but in terms of your own work, do you see any sort of prospects in the future for where you might want to direct another research question?
Yeah, I'm more interested in now the transnational formulations of sexuality, mobility, border crossing. So it's still a kind of in progress kind of research, but given the Turkish situation in the Middle East right now, there's so many room to do research with not necessarily with non-Turkish Middle Eastern, not necessarily with Turkish people, but also non-Turkish Middle Eastern groups. Now they're establishing a life, developing a life in Turkey, and what it means, for example, to live in Turkey for LGBTQ refugee or asylum seekers in Turkey. So maybe my direction is going to be around the questions of transnational sexualities, queer mobility in the Middle East. I'm still thinking around it. This is one particular trajectory that I might take.
Oh, that's very fascinating. It seems like it would be a great continuity.
Yeah, thank you.
You have to come back and tell us about it after your next trip. But yeah, thank you so much, Asli, for coming on and talking with us here on This Anthropological Life.
Thank you so much for having me here. And I'm just, you know, happy to share my larger research with the people in general. This was a great opportunity for me as well.
Yeah, now we're all about trying to diffuse anthropological research out.
You're doing a great job, people. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated. It was a pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you.
Well, tune in again next week, guys. As always, this is Anil Tripathi.
And Ryan Collins.
Have a good one.